The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 2.
Chapter 8. 3 hours later, on the other side of our boat, shielded from the castle, I slowly lowered Jennifer into the small rubber Zodiac. Already in, Knuckles helped to keep her from falling overboard, something necessary given the dress she was wearing. A black, form-fitting top with long sleeves, the dress was actually a Lycra bodysuit. The long flowing skirt was simply applied to her waist by Velcro, allowing her to remove it and operate unencumbered. At the small of her back was a waterproof pouch, giving the skirt the impression that she was wearing a bustle. In her left hand was a pair of high heels. Knuckles stabilized her waist, and I let go of her hand, saying, "Looks like the task force is going to get their money's worth from those shoes." She sat on the bench in the middle of the small rubber craft and smiled, saying, "My favorite piece of task force kit." She'd had to dress up once before on a mission in Kenya 6 months ago, and had gone hog wild buying an outfit on the task force's dime, to include a ridiculously expensive pair of high heels called Jimmy Choos. I couldn't believe how much they cost, and neither could the bean counters when we returned. But it was a successful mission, so the boss, Kurt Hale, had shushed them and allowed Jennifer to keep the shoes. Up until now, they'd held a special place in our closet, gathering dust. I climbed down the ladder and took my position in the rear of the Zodiac. I was nothing but the infill-exfill platform for this mission. I said, "Comms check." First, Knuckles talked, then Jennifer answered. I couldn't hear either one, because they were wearing microscopic earbuds that slaved through Bluetooth to small transmitters hidden in their clothing. Ordinarily, we communicated through a proprietary earpiece that worked encrypted through the cell network with our special task force phones. Looking like an ordinary cell phone Bluetooth, they usually blended in fine. But since the host of this party confiscated all cell phones, running around with that in their ears would look a little silly. We'd opted for a covert communication system, which had much less power. It would allow Jennifer to talk to Knuckles, but I wouldn't be able to hear anything on the dive boat. Satisfied, Knuckles looked at me and nodded. Dressed in his tuxedo, his hair in surf boy disarray, he really did look like something from an Abercrombie and Fitch poster. I chuckled. He said, "What's so funny?" I glanced at Jennifer, her dirty blonde hair piled high on her head, wearing expensive-looking earrings and a faux emerald necklace, and said, "I can't believe we get paid for this shit." Knuckles grinned and said, "Somebody's got to do it." I said, "Okay, primary mission is the audio for the Brazilian and the guy from Qatar. Specifically, any discussion of investing in the mine and the reasons why Qatar would be interested. Secondary mission is the cell phones. Jennifer, if you can't get upstairs to the master bedroom, let it go." She nodded but said, "I think I can get up there, as a female." "How?" She grinned and said, "Let me worry about that." I paused for a moment, then nodded. She was pretty good at solving problems, and I knew she was working some plan that wouldn't be finalized until she was in the lion's den, after she could take a look at the atmospherics. I said, "Okay, showtime. Knuckles, cast off." He did so and I turned around, starting the outboard by punching a single button. It was a fairly powerful motor, but was electric. All that came out was a small whine like a remote control car. We broke the cover of the dive boat and circled to the left, towards a small beach and away from rocky outcroppings the house sat on. We'd remain out of sight of the castle until we were beneath the level of the rock, then slide in parallel to the coast, out of view of the security by the pool. Scooting along barely fast enough to cause a wake, I said, "Any changes to contingencies?" Knuckles said, "Nope. This goes south and we're running straight to the water. I'll activate the beacon in my phone once I get the chance. But the only early warning will be you with an eye on the scope. You see us getting thrown out, you start chugging forward in the Zodiac." I nodded, then said, "What if you can't get out?" "Then you'd better call in a task force assault team." Neither one of them had a weapon, because we decided it would be too much to try to hide. Well, the lack of weapons wasn't exactly true. They had their hands, and their fighting skills were positively lethal. I grinned and said, "Not much of a plan." Jennifer said, "We'll get out. That'll be the easy part. Getting in is going to be the issue. We might be in the water before you've made it back to the boat. Knuckles glanced at me, and I saw a smile in the moonlight. Jennifer clearly didn't like our plan. Knuckles had come up with it, and I thought it was downright devious. We reached a point where we were below the line of sight from the men on the patio, and I slowed the boat to a crawl, putting on my night vision goggles. I cut closer to the shore, paralleling the rock and looking for the parapet of the lowest sunbathing deck. I saw it above me, about 10 feet up the cliff, a primitive set of stairs cut out of the stone leading down from it to the water. Jennifer pulled out a thermal scope, checking for body heat along the top of the crest and around the deck. I puttered closer, seeing the waves slap into the rock. I whispered, "Hey, the surf's worse than it was before. I'm going to get bounced into the cliff." Crouching down, Knuckles said, "You call that surf? That's nothing. I should have known better than to let an army guy drive the boat. Just get it close. I'll buffer while Jennifer gets out, then I'll go, pushing you away." We crept towards the stairway, and I slowed further still, letting Jennifer complete her sweep. She put the scope down and nodded at me, her eyes bright with excitement, making me grin involuntarily. A year ago, she would have been soiling her bodysuit. Now she looked like a kid about to take a roller coaster ride, eager for the prospect of some harmless thrills. Only this one might not be so harmless. We bumped into the rock, the underside eaten away from years of surf, making a mushroom-like shape. Knuckles grabbed a plant growing out of the stone and pulled us forward until we were abreast of the primitive staircase. Shoes around her neck, Jennifer scrambled up, clambering with one hand while hoisting her skirt with the other. I waited until she was clear, then hissed at Knuckles. Still holding the plant and starting the exit, he turned around. I said, "Remember what we talked about. She likes to push things. She wants those cell phones. But don't let her push too hard. You have the experience here." He grinned and nodded, saying, "I'll bring her back in one piece. We might be wet, but she'll be fine." He slipped out of sight, kicking the rubber of the Zodiac and pushing me away from the rocks. I did a tight turn and motored about 50 feet away, sweeping the crest of the sunbathing deck with my night vision. I caught a slash of movement, but nothing else. I turned around and began steaming back to our dive boat and my lonely vigil.
Chapter 9. Clinging like a cat to the steps carved in the rock, Jennifer waited until Knuckles was behind her. He tapped her, and she began to climb. She moved slowly, taking the steps one at a time, bent forward so far she could almost go up on all fours, listening for any sign of movement over the soft noise of the surf. They reached the plateau of the sunbathing deck, and the lights from the house spilled out. Jennifer paused and surveyed, seeing 5 lounge chairs lined up, facing the ocean. At the back of the deck was a proper staircase made of crushed coral, leading to the next terraced deck, then a further staircase going up to the infinity pool and patio. The noise from the party spilled down the hill, tinkles of glass, conversation, and laughter. She rose up slightly, until she could pinpoint the security at the edge of the patio. She ducked back down and whispered, "They're still in place, on our side of the pool." Knuckles grinned and said, "Should we use one of the chairs or just lay down on the deck?" Jennifer scowled, inwardly cursing Pike for talking her into this plan. He routinely came up with some pretty outrageous ideas, but agreeing to Knuckles' suggestion was about the worst. After spitballing various ways to get inside, they decided that they needed to play on the guard force's reason to exist. In other words, let the guard force find them, but do so in such a way that they'd be laughing instead of suspicious. Let the guard force discover them engaged in something embarrassing, then apologize in the face of the laughter and slink back into the party. But what? What could the guards stumble upon that wouldn't get them thrown out? Knuckles had come up with the idea, sex on the beach, or more appropriately, sex on the sunbathing deck. Jennifer was mortified just thinking about it. Knuckles said, "Well?" Jennifer shook her head and said, "The lounge chair." Knuckles said, "Me on the bottom or you?" "Jesus, seriously?" "Well, it's got to look real." "You on the damn bottom." He crept to a chair and lay down. She straddled his waist, glaring at him. He said, "Put your shoes on." "What?" "Your damn Sammy Foos, or whatever they're called. They're still around your neck. And it'd look pretty silly when they find us." She bent over and put on the high heels, muttering. She leaned back up and said, "Satisfied?" "Oh, yeah. This is every male's fantasy. High heels, formal dress." She tried to thump him in the head, but he blocked it, continuing, "Secret mission in the Cayman Islands. I'm with Pike. I can't believe I'm getting paid." Exasperated, she said, "Are you done? Can we get on with the mission?" He grinned and said, "Yeah, final equipment check. You can get to the octopus and your third lung if this goes south?" She reached back and felt the butt pack, saying, "Yeah, it's good. All I need to do is ditch this skirt." He said, "Stand up for a minute." She did, and he unbuckled his belt, dropping his pants to his mid-thigh, but not touching his underwear. He patted his lap and said, "Okay then, lover, let's get it on. Start moaning." She did, embarrassingly trying to sound like she thought someone in the throes of passion would sound. She'd never really paid attention to what she truly did. It came out like a wounded kitten. Knuckles said, "That's it? Well, what the hell am I supposed to do?" "Shit, I can barely hear that, and I'm underneath you. Get them over here." She shook her head and took a breath, then let out a moan like a porno film. Knuckles whispered, "That a girl. Pretend like I'm Pike." Her eyes flashed, and she let out another moan, which sounded dangerously close to a lion closing in on a gazelle. Knuckles said, "Might want to tone that one down a bit. You sound a little like you want to hurt me." She said, "Shouldn't you be helping?" and dug her hands into the soft flesh right above his hip, twisting. He involuntarily yelped, grabbing her hand, and they both saw the flashlight beam flick above their heads. He let go and said, "This is it, get ready to act." She moaned again, getting into it, and the flashlight came bouncing down the stairs. They jerked their heads up as if in surprise. Then Jennifer sprang to her feet, pretending to adjust her dress. Knuckles leapt up, buckling his pants. The guard said, "What the hell are you two doing down here?" Jennifer ducked her head and moved behind Knuckles. Looking sheepish, he said, "Nothing, nothing at all, just looking at the view." The guard tried to hide a grin, but could not. He said, "Sir, madame, I'm sorry, but the party is up at the house. Please, for my job, save this for after you leave." Knuckles adjusted his tuxedo, gathered his feigned dignity, and said, "Sure. Sorry. Can you keep this between us, please?" The guard nodded, obviously having no intention of doing so once the party was over. And the three marched up the stairs, entering the house. Nobody paid them a second glance. Jennifer couldn't believe it had worked, whispering that into Knuckles' ear. He said, "It was the moaning." She dug her hand into his kidney, twisting the flesh and making him jump. She said, "Now it's your turn. Find the target." They passed across the patio, the separate bedroom off to the left, a man outside. Knuckles said, "Still no way in from the front." She nodded, and they entered through the sliding glass door to the lower level. Knuckles looked around, seeing impossibly beautiful couples dripping wealth, but not his target. They went up the wooden staircase to the main floor, and Knuckles saw him sitting on a couch in the corner, next to the balcony. The Brazilian and a chair next to him, both deep in conversation. Knuckles took stock of the area, seeing the acre-sized kitchen island, the expanse of food, and servers darting in and out among the guests. He looked for a couple close enough to the targets to be worthwhile. He found one about their age and said, "Let's go. You lead, I follow. Comment on the woman's dress or something." He got no response and said, "Jennifer, you switched on?" She was staring further in, at the metal spiral staircase leading to the master bedroom. She refocused and said, "Yeah, I'm good." He saw where her attention had been and said, "One step at a time. That may be a bridge too far." She snatched a champagne glass from a passing waiter and said, "Let's get in the fight." Walking towards the couple, she said, "I'll start the introductions, but I'm going to excuse myself. Check things out." "Check things out how?" "Just look around. You've got the magic microphones. It's your mission." They got closer, and Jennifer took in the décolletage of the woman. She said, "Just remember to look her in the eye." "What's that mean?" She glanced sideways at him but said nothing. He came within frontal view of the woman and said, okay, I see." Jennifer introduced herself, asking something innocuous about the woman's jewelry, then turned it over to Knuckles, rotating around to let him enter the conversation closest to the targets. Knuckles shook the man's hand and began spilling out his cover story as the CEO of a paint firm specializing in anti-corrosive and low-visibility enamel, dedicated to the U.S. military. Jennifer was actually amazed at how knowledgeable he sounded. Nothing like the man-child who demanded she moan for a thrill. She asked the woman for the location to a bathroom, then moved away, following her directions, sliding in between the groups of people, and weaving her way to the back of the room. She reached a hallway and saw exactly what she wanted, a line of three women waiting outside a door. She said, "Is this the only bathroom?"
"I doubt it, but it's the only one outside of a bedroom."
"Perfect." She went back to the great room, seeing Knuckles still engrossed in conversation, and catching him surreptitiously stealing a glance at the woman's cleavage. "Damn Neanderthal." She pulled up next to him and caught his attention. He smiled and said, "That was quick." Appearing embarrassed, she said,
"Honey, I really have to go to the bathroom, but there's a line outside."
Knuckles looked at her in confusion and said,
"Yeah? I guess wait."
She bored into him with her eyes and said,
"I really have to go. Something I ate."
She was beginning to wonder if he would make the connection when it finally clicked. He said, "Let's see if we can find another one." He pointed to the winding metal staircase and said, "You guys know if there's a bathroom up there?" The man said,
"I came early and got a tour. It's the master bedroom, and yeah, it has a bathroom. But I don't know if they want guests to use it."
Jennifer put on a pouting face, looking at Knuckles like she was a dimwit wanting him to solve the problem. He said,
"I'm sure they won't mind."
He flagged down one of the roving security and said,
"My date really needs to use the bathroom, but the one in back has a line. Something she ate. Would you mind if she went upstairs?"
The guy hesitated, then spoke into his wrist. He waited for a response, touching his earpiece, then said,
"That would be fine, but I'll have to take her up."
Jennifer smiled and said,
"Thank you. I really have to go."
Knuckles squinted at her and said,
"I'll be right here. Don't take too long."
She nodded, and he flicked his eyes at the targets and said,
"You do, and I might wander off looking for another date."
Jennifer got his meaning, but the comment drew a scowl from the other woman. Jennifer pecked him on the cheek and said,
"I'll be quick, I promise. Nobody else will have to moan for you."
She walked away, leaving Knuckles to respond to the couple now standing with their mouths open. Chapter 10. Jennifer followed the security man up the winding staircase, feeling the adrenaline build.
She started to wipe a sheen of nervous sweat off of her face, then realized it might help her story. They broke into a large master suite dominated by floor-to-ceiling windows and glass doors facing the ocean. The man pointed across the bed to another door, one that slid into the wall. Jennifer grabbed her stomach and hurried through the room, saying,
"Thank you. I might be a while."
She slid the door closed, made a show of noise by dropping the toilet seat, then focused on the window. It was large enough. She kicked off her Jimmy Choo's and began to pull the Velcro of her skirt, the noise sounding like she was tearing a bedsheet. She stopped and listened. Nothing. She looked at the wall and saw three light switches, one down. She flicked it and was relieved to hear a fan crank up, the noise enough to cover her transformation. She peeled off the skirt, leaving her in what looked like a black leotard. She piled the clothes and shoes in the walk-in shower, not really sure what hiding them would do. She slid the window open and stood on the toilet, slithering through legs first and hanging by her fingers from the sill. She glanced left and saw two security men on the paved drive, one smoking, neither looking her way. She looked right and saw her window, at ground level and below the foliage. In between were two other windows she'd have to avoid. She surveyed the exterior, assessing what she had to work with. The building itself was constructed of stone, made to look like a real castle, with irregular bumps and ridges that were perfect for her skills. A gymnast in a previous life, she'd worked a spell with Cirque du Soleil and found she had a talent for free climbing. Like a gecko, she could scramble up just about anything, and the task force took full advantage of that skill. Here, she would need every bit of it, because going down a vertical surface was exponentially harder than going up. Instead of eyesight, she'd have to rely on feel. She slid her toes to the right, searching for crevices and finding perches. She followed with her hands, leaving the safety of the windowsill. She began to climb down, moving as fast as possible without slipping, curving around the castle towards her target. Eventually, she was at the top of the foliage, and close enough to the ground. She pushed off and dropped, hitting softly in the mulch. She leaned against the rock wall underneath the bathroom window of her target room, and did nothing but breathe deeply for a few seconds. She called on her tiny radio.
"I'm down, outside the bedroom."
She heard Knuckles say a sentence, followed by, "Okay, that's good," using his ordinary conversation with another guest as a means to let her know he'd heard. She stood up and found the bathroom was actually sunk into the hillside a little bit, leaving the window a mere 4 feet off the ground. She rotated her butt pack around to the front and pulled out a red lens penlight, shining it on the lock. They knew the castle had a built-in security system, but also that it was disabled during the parties. What they didn't know was the type of window locks in use. Jennifer was hoping it was like the one she'd left upstairs, a simple sliding lever on the left and right. It was. She fished in her pouch again and pulled out a flexible metal tool designed specifically for such breaches. And within 2 minutes, she was through the window and inside the bathroom. She alerted Knuckles, then crept to the door and peeked out. The lights in the bedroom off, but the illumination from the outside patio giving a soft glow. The room was empty, the drapes pulled across the sliding door. As her eyes adjusted, she saw a desk, a widescreen television, and stacked neatly on the king-sized bed, 2 dozen Faraday bags, looking like Easter eggs waiting to be plucked. She opened her pouch again, pulled out what Knuckles had called her third lung, a miniature scuba tank, and set it aside. She removed a device that had a round disc in the center.
about 2 inches in diameter and 1 inch thick, with multiple cords extending out from it. Called an octopus, its sole function was accessing and copying the entire contents of a cell phone SIM card. Contacts, call history, text messages, surfed web pages, all of it would be duplicated by the octopus, even deleted information. And it had a dozen cords coming out with adapters for every conceivable type of cell phone. She placed it on the bed and picked out packets 4 and 17, the ones from their surveillance earlier. She opened the Faraday bags and dumped out 7 phones of various makes. She plugged them all in, punched a button on the center of the disk, then sat down to wait, knowing that some encryption protocols would take longer to break than others. 1 minute in, proud of her work, she heard a call that caused a jolt of adrenaline.
"Coco, Coco, the host is getting antsy. He's seen the security at the top of the stairs, and he's asking questions."
"Uh-oh. Knuckles, I'm not done. I need another minute here, and probably 10 to get back inside. I have to climb the wall again."
"I don't think we have that sort of time. Abort, get out."
Already moving, unplugging the phones that were complete and shoving them in their respective bag, she said,
"Interdict him, slow him down."
"I'm going to try. What's your ETA? What do I have to work with?"
"Best case, 7 minutes.
She unplugged the other phones, the last two still being drained, and placed the Faraday bags back where she found them. She scuttled back to the window, shoving everything back into her pouch. She was outside in seconds, staring up at the wall. She took a breath, found her first handhold, and hoisted herself off the loam of the ground, starting the climb back. Chapter 11. Knuckles saw the host talking to security, but wasn't unduly concerned. They'd done nothing to Spike, and nobody at all had paid them a second glance, with most buying his CEO story, hook, line, and sinker. His concern spiked when the host pointed up the spiral staircase, clearly asking why one of the security men was in the master bedroom. A diminutive man of about 60 with close-cropped gray hair and skin the color of coffee, the host wouldn't appear to be a threat. But Knuckles saw how the security man kowtowed to him, nodding his head repeatedly, then talking into his sleeve. Clearly, the host held a power far exceeding his physical stature. Knuckles excused himself from his conversation, not wanting to pull his directional microphones away from the target still seated on the couch, but feeling something amiss. He called Jennifer, getting the readout on the length of time she had left, and felt the first bit of adrenaline begin to flow. He watched the host carefully, checking for a change in demeanor. The man at the top of the stairs came down and talked to him, then pointed at Knuckles. Into the radio, he said, "It's reached a boiling point. Status?" He heard a grunt, then,
"Climbing. Can't talk."
He started moving towards the host, saying,
"Give me a time.
5. Need 5.
"Shit, that ain't gonna happen."
He walked up to the host and stuck out his hand, introducing himself and using his CEO title as he had previously. The host said,
"I don't remember that company being invited."
Knuckles gave his most charming smile and said, "Well, here we are, and it's a great party. There's nothing like coming down to the Caymans on business, hoping to get some diving in." The host cut him off.
"Who is upstairs in the bedroom?"
"My date. We ate at a hole in the wall in Georgetown, and I think some of the conch was bad. She's been on the toilet most of the afternoon."
The host nodded and said,
"Would you mind showing me your invitation?"
Knuckles said, "Sure, sure," then made a show of searching the pockets in his tuxedo. He came up empty, extended his hands, and said,
"I don't know. Maybe I left it with a man out front."
The host flicked his head at one of the guards and he disappeared. The host said,
Let's go check on your date. I don't want any medical emergencies.
He started up the staircase, and Knuckles said, She'll be fine. It's just Montezuma's revenge. The host ignored him. The security man that had come from the top of the stairs held out his hand, telling Knuckles to follow. Knuckles began to climb, keying his radio and saying, We're coming up the stairs. The host said, What? Knuckles said, Nothing, and heard Jennifer grunt. I'm not there. I'm not there. Shit. They reached the master suite, walking around the bed to the sliding bathroom door. The host put his ear to the door, listening for a second, then knocked, saying, Miss? Miss? Are you all right? No answer. Knuckles pretended to be concerned, leaning forward and knocking on the door himself. He said, Jennifer, is everything okay? No answer. The host pulled the handle, finding it locked. He turned to the security man and said,
Open this, right now.
The guard turned and scurried downstairs. Knuckles made a show of banging on the door, acting like he was about to panic, shouting her name, creating enough noise to cover her return, if she made it. The guard came huffing back up the stairs, carrying a small crowbar. He pushed Knuckles out of the way, jammed it in between the crack of the door and the wall. He cranked back hard. The door jamb split, and the snap of noise spiked Knuckles into the next zone. No longer concerned with the charade, he now went into combat mode, preparing for a controlled dose of violence. In the split second between the man jamming in the crowbar and the door exploding open, Knuckles sized up the two men, determining positioning and his next actions. He knew he'd have to take out the security guy first, but couldn't become so engaged that the host escaped back downstairs. He had to take them both out before an alarm was raised, which meant some serious damage to the guy holding the crowbar. There was no time for a nice submission. The security man pried the crowbar loose, then slammed the door into the sliding well, the wooden protection rolling back with a finality that only Knuckles understood. Knuckles stutter-stepped forward, winding up for a temple strike, and a shriek filled the air. His arm cocked, the muscles a millisecond away from putting the guard out for the night. Knuckles caught a glimpse of Jennifer and a tangle of clothes. She screamed, Get out of here, asshole! They all stumbled back, the host looking mortified. Into the damaged doorway, he said,
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
He turned to Knuckles and said,
I apologize profusely.
Knuckles looked indignant, and Jennifer came through the door holding her skirt and flashing her eyes. She said,
What in the world is going on? I can't use the bathroom without you guys breaking in. Who's in charge of this damn event?
The host bowed his head and said,
My sincerest apologies. We thought there was a medical emergency. We thought...
He let his comments dribble off, looking to Knuckles for support. Jennifer glared at the host and said,
Tell that to the next woman you barge in on.
She looked at Knuckles and gave an imperceptible nod, saying,
I've had enough of this party, honey. Let's go.
She stormed toward the stairs and the men followed, the host saying,
Please don't make a scene. I'm sorry. We only had your best interests at heart.
They reached the bottom and were met by the security man who'd left previously. He leaned in and whispered to the host. He nodded, his face hardening. Knuckles took Jennifer's hand and headed to the stairwell leading to the bottom floor. And escape. He heard the host's voice float above the crowd.
Wait! Could I have a word before you go?
Chapter 12. Knuckles held up, turning around and pulling Jennifer to a stop. The host said,
You aren't on the invitation list. There is no record of you coming through the front door.
Knuckles said, I've had about enough of this buffoonery. Doesn't matter anyway. You got what you wanted. We're leaving.
One of the security men circled to the right, and the host said,
I'm sorry. Not until I know who you are.
I told you.
The host looked at the security man who'd whispered in his ear earlier. He said,
They do have a website based in Tampa, Florida. That checks out, but they sure aren't on the invitation list.
The host nodded, then looked at Knuckles. He said,
You can go, but not until we search you for electronics.
The security man understood what was required before the host could tell him. He spoke into his sleeve.
Knuckles said, What are you talking about? We had to give all of that up when we came in here.
Yes, I'm wondering why you haven't asked for your cell phones back before you leave.
Knuckles silently kicked himself and said, We were searched when we came in, which I'm now regretting. We don't have any electronics. Come on.
My date has a little stomach ache, and now you want to search us? Fuck you. We're leaving.
Even as the words left his mouth, Knuckles knew that it would do no good. A guard from the front door approached, carrying a wand like those seen in airports. No way could Knuckles allow that thing to come near them. The conversation had reached a head. It was time to leave. He said,
Okay, fine, fine, run that thing over us, but after that, we're out of here.
He turned to Jennifer and said, You got your third lung handy? Ignoring the man, Jennifer said,
Yes, but we still need to get down to the first floor.
Yeah, I know. That could be a little dicey.
Jennifer looked to the balcony, guest moving about, enjoying the breeze and the view. She said,
Not really.
The host appeared confused at their conversation, and Jennifer said,
These shoes are killing me.
She bent down and took them off, holding them in her hand. She looked at Knuckles and said,
Try to keep up.
The guard with the wand motioned to Knuckles, telling him to hold out his arms. All eyes focused on Knuckles, Jennifer took off running, exploding straight through the open sliding glass door, their original targets on the couch staring like everyone else. Before the men around Knuckles had even realized she was moving, she vaulted herself over the balcony, disappearing from view. The last Knuckles saw was her Velcro skirt floating away, caught in the ocean breeze.
Holy shit.
He turned to the open mouth of the host and said,
Great party. Gotta go.
He sprinted through the room, racing through the sliding glass door and following Jennifer over the balcony, his feet finding purchase on the inch shelf of concrete at the bottom of the balcony. His hand still holding the railing, he searched for Jennifer. He saw her scrambling down a pillar, holding her Jimmy Choo's in her mouth. She hit the patio, creating a stir, but held her ground and looked up. He heard the host shout and saw the two security goons around the pool begin to react. Jennifer saw it as well and began running to the ocean, threading her way through the crowd. Knuckles judged the drop, then scrambled until he was hanging from the bottom of the balcony. He took one more look, making sure he wasn't going to break a leg, and let go. He landed hard and rolled, slamming into a statuesque blonde in a red dress, throwing her drink into the air. He leapt up, ignoring her shouts, disgusted that he didn't have a witty James Bond response. He sprinted around the infinity pool, reaching the stairs that led down to the sunbathing decks. Jennifer was right in front of him, skipping down the steps two at a time. A guard was to her front, both arms out wide, like he was trying to capture a loose animal. It was the man who'd discovered them doing hanky-panky. Knuckles took the steps in leaping bounds, closing the gap. He saw Jennifer fling her high heels at the man's head, causing him to raise his arms to block the projectiles. She slid low at that exact moment, taking the guard's legs out from under him and springing back up. He continued to fight, trying to grab her from the ground. He got one ankle in his grasp, and Knuckles reached the scrum, punching him in the head with a rapid 1-2 strike, stunning him. Jennifer jerked her leg free, and he jumped over the body, shouting, You got your lung? She held it up,
and he dug into his own pouch at the small of his back, seeing a squad of security racing out of the house, all convinced they had their targets cornered against the ocean. They reached the lower sunbathing deck, and Knuckles ripped off his shoes, then tied his tuxedo jacket around his waist, not wanting to leave it behind for the host to find all of the hidden microphones. He glanced back, seeing the men bounding down the stairs. He flicked out an 8-foot section of 550 cord, one end already tied to his wrist, the other with a loop for her. He tossed the end to her, speaking fast. "When we hit the surf, I'm going right, away from the lights. Just keep swimming. You feel the line go taut, swim back into the slack." He held out his third lung and said, "Remember, we only have about 20 breaths with these things. We go under and don't come up. I'm going until we're out of air. You run out first, give the line a tug." The third lung was a modified scuba gadget based on the HEED, Helicopter Emergency Egress Device, used by air crews flying over water. A quarter of the size, it had a quarter of the life. She nodded and Knuckles moved to the cliff edge, Jennifer putting the loop around her left wrist and waiting on his command. Knuckles looked back, saw the men running down the stairs, now past the first sunbathing deck, and said, "Hope Pike's watching. Time to go," and jumped off the cliff. They broke the water together, bobbed up long enough to emplace the small mouthpiece of the third lung, and Knuckles went under, stroking hard. He swam with fast, deep strokes to get away from the light, hoping to cause their pursuers to see nothing on the surface and wonder what the hell had just happened. The ocean became black, the light from the castle fading away. He kept swimming, one hand extended to his front to prevent him from slamming into a rock, using an internal compass and the experience from a bazillion night dives to dictate where he should go. 3 minutes later, he felt a tug on his line and stopped swimming. He drifted to the surface, breaking the water silently. He saw they were on the western side of the outcropping, nothing but tangled scrub in between them and the house, vague shouting drifting over the surf. Jennifer popped up next to him, just as quietly. She dropped the lung and gasped, whispering, "Are you a fish? I ran out 30 seconds ago." He said, "Why didn't you tug?" She said, "I thought for sure you would run out too." He chuckled and said, "We keep going west." He pulled out his phone, an innocuous replica of an iPhone 6, but definitely not original equipment, to include the fact that it was waterproof, and initiated an internal beacon. He said, "Hope Pike's on the ball." 20 minutes later, now swimming on the surface, the castle far behind them, Knuckles caught a glimpse of movement on the open water. He aimed his phone at the movement and took a picture, causing the camera to flash. The movement swerved his way and he bobbed, waiting. The Zodiac pulled abreast of them, making no noise, Pike working the motor. He said, "I take it things didn't go as planned." Knuckles tossed his waterproof pouch over the gunwale and said, "The microphones and earbuds are destroyed, but the digital recorder and octopus are fine. They have no idea what our target was or what we were doing there. As far as I'm concerned, it was mission success." Jennifer threw in her own pouch, grabbed the rope anchored to points around the Zodiac, and said, "Not really." Knuckles said, "What? You didn't get the phone data?" She hoisted herself over the side and said, "Yeah, I got it. But I lost my damn Jimmy Choo's."
Chapter 13. Murphy's Pub was beginning to fill up with the happy hour crowd, the locals starting to push out the tourists by sheer numbers. Having worked plenty of hours up in Washington, D.C., I knew the rhythm of Old Town, Alexandria, and had managed to get a table in the back facing the door. Even though it was a little touristy, I still loved it, and since I was the stationary element for this meeting, I got to pick the location. If it had been up to Knuckles, It would have been at some hipster coffee shop, where he could hit on a co-ed using his sensitive lines. We'd been back a week from the Caymans, and for some reason Kurt Hale had wanted a face-to-face meeting. It wasn't unusual, really, but it didn't happen that often, especially since I'd left active duty and started working with Jennifer. We were partners in a company called Grow Your Recovery Services, a unique, or as Jennifer liked to call it, boutique business that specialized in archaeological work around the world. We didn't actually do the digging. We facilitated it by coordinating everything from getting the proper permits from the host nation to providing security on the site. Since we'd formed in 2011, we'd been contracted by everyone from private millionaires who fancied themselves to be Indiana Jones to accredited universities. But by far, our primary work was for the U.S. government, as in the task force. Created with support from Kurt Hale, our true mission was as a cover organization conducting counter-terrorist missions around the world. Because it was under deep cover as a functioning for-profit corporation, we didn't want to be associated with the umbrella cover of Bladesdell Consulting, the task force used over in Clarendon, and thus did these little face-to-face meetings at innocuous places in D.C. Jennifer came over carrying a couple of drinks, sat down and said, "Quicker service from the bar." I saw that there wasn't a lime attached to the glass and said, "Is that just a Coke?" Indignant, she said, "It's only 4:30, and we're on the clock." I started to mutter something about Kurt paying for the drinks when I saw Knuckles come through the door by himself. I waved and he walked over, taking a chair. I said, "Where's Kurt?" "Held up doing something with personnel, some sort of crisis. He'll be here shortly." He told me to go ahead. I said, "Okay, and what's this all about? I know it's not that castle mission. Nothing in it that was life or death, unless he's going to make me pay for the waterlogged electronics." He laughed and said, "Well, it's not the castle mission per se, but it is because of that. Remember Guy George?" "Yeah, of course. His brother was just KIA, right?" Guy had served in the same troop as me in a special mission unit on Fort Bragg, before I'd been recruited to the task force by Kurt. We knew each other well enough, and had been in more than one scrape overseas together, back in the bad days of Iraq. Well, back in the U.S. bad days of Iraq. I didn't think Iraq would see any good days during my lifetime. Guy had come over to the task force a few years after me, along with a SEAL called Decoy, the one who Jennifer had seen killed in front of her. They'd done assessment and selection together. Then they'd gone to Johnny's team, and Decoy had come to mine. Well, that's not exactly true. Decoy had gone to my old team. Knuckles, as my second in command, had taken over as team leader after I'd left active duty, under a cloud. Since then, I'd come back and had become team leader again, as a civilian in Grolier Recovery Services. As Facebook would say, it's complicated. Knuckles said, "Yeah, that's right. Guy's brother was KIA in Afghanistan working with 7th Group. You know the Oversight Council update is tomorrow, right?" "No, I don't keep track of that shit. That's what Kurt gets paid for." "Yeah, I'm with you. Well, it was also our biannual monkey show for the Oversight Council, where they anoint some poor fuck with an award. Guy was the chosen one this time for that hit in Croatia. The one that gave us the intel on the vice president's son." "Good for him. Better him than me. What's that got to do with this meeting?" "He was adamant about not going to his brother's memorial in Montana, saying he would wait until the burial at Arlington. So he was good to go for the ceremony. The memorial is either tomorrow or the next day, I can't remember. Anyway, after our data from the Caymans was fed into the system, he had some meltdown, I don't know why. Long and the short of it is he decided he needed to go, needed a break. So it's a good thing. If I were Kurt, I'd have ordered him to leave. Better he's doing it voluntarily." I had a little personal experience on losing someone close to you, losing blood kin. I, too, had been ordered to stand down after, and had ignored it until it had become a blister of pus, which had been the reason I'd left active duty and the task force under a cloud. I was glad Guy was taking the time off. Knuckles grinned and said, "The so what is that Kurt needs a new awardee, someone to prance in front of the council, and that Cayman mission fits the bill." I immediately snapped back, "Bullshit, I'm not doing that. I'm a damn civilian. This is supposed to help out guys on active duty, guys like you. I am not going in front of the council and getting some bullshit award. No way. Jennifer understood my tolerance for such dog and pony shows, which was non-existent, but also saw the bigger picture. She said, hey, come on. It's not all gunfighting. You want to play in the game, you also have to play by the rules. All they want to do is thank you. Look at it this way. It's your chance to show them you're a thinking, erudite man instead of a muscle with a trigger finger. She looked at Knuckles and said, it might help alleviate all of the fear those guys have about Grolier Recovery Services. Pike can be the smartest guy in the room when he's forced to act like a human. I think it's a good idea. Knuckles grinned and conspiratorially leaned forward. He said, I'm glad you feel that way, Coco, because they don't give a shit about Pike. The award's for you. Chapter 14. I heard his words, and embarrassingly, my first thought was, what the hell, I'm not good enough? Like a guy who said he'd never go to a party, then found out he wasn't invited. Jennifer said, me? What for? The whole purpose of those awards is to help the guys still on active duty. I've never even been in the military. Knuckles said, yeah, I know. But we're in a whole new world. Kurt wants to showcase you, no offense, but you're the only female operator in the task force. It'll sell well on the political front. I said, that's absolute bullshit. No way is GRS going to be leveraged for some sort of political horse trading. They can use our company for killing terrorists, but we're not playing those games. Kurt can't just bang the drum and ask us to start dancing. Knuckles laughed and held up his hands. Calm down. I told Kurt this would happen. Nobody's being hurt. Guy will still get his award. He just won't have a ceremony. Kurt's got something he wants to say tomorrow at the council meeting, and the only time he can guarantee they'll all attend is one of these award ceremonies. He wasn't going to tell them it was off. Jennifer said, I don't like being a showpiece. I didn't come to the task force because I have some mission for women's rights. It's hard enough just getting any of the males to trust me. This ceremony will set that back to the beginning. The words hung for a bit, then Knuckles said, remember what you just told Pike about showing the council what he's really like? And how that would do some good? This will do some good. The task force knows what you're capable of. This won't change that. She balled up a napkin and said, you know what I can do. You and the rest of Pike's team are the only ones who do. Decoy's dead. The others look at me as a liability. I know how this will play in the team room. Knuckles looked at me and I shrugged, agreeing with her. Fuck the council, I thought. He said, this award isn't going to alter your actions on the decoy tape. That's set in stone. She flinched at the words, seeing the fight in her mind and not sure what to say. I leaned forward into Knuckles' face, angry that he'd brought that up. It was an event she was still dealing with, alone at night, when the bad man comes. Don't go there, that's not right. Knuckles said, it is right. And if you were the team leader you claim to be, instead of protecting her as her partner, you'd see it. Her reputation has nothing to do with the ceremony. She already owns her reputation. She said, this has nothing to do with Decoy. He cut her off and said, yes, it does. At the end of the day, just like you told Pike, it's all about operating, all about permission. Stroke the council a little bit. Make them feel good about what we're doing. Take off the edge of killer commando crap and put on the pink ruffle of women's equality. Who cares if it's fake? The men in the team room won't, I promise. Pike's no longer there, but I am. She leaned back, not liking the logic. I didn't either, but I saw it to be true. The Oversight Council was designed to execute task force operations in the absence of politics, but in America, that was impossible. Politics always trumped the mission, always. And that damn decoy tape spoke for itself. I said, so Jennifer's going to be paraded in front of the council tomorrow? What's she supposed to say? What's the message? Knuckles looked towards the door and said, ask the man yourself. I saw Kurt coming down the length of the bar. Knuckles grinned and said, I'm just a team member. He winked at me, and for the first time, I wondered when he'd leave my team. After my fall from grace, then my return, he'd voluntarily turned over command of his team, my team, solely because of our relationship. We were closer than brothers, but hearing his words today, he proved again he was clearly smarter than 95% of the men inside the task force, and they were some pretty smart individuals to begin with. Truth be told, he was smarter than me, and I was keeping him down by making him stay forever, number two. How long would he be willing to remain there? The thought scared me. Kurt approached the table and Jennifer stood, giving him an embrace. He said, "How's my favorite female operator?" She said, "You mean your only female operator? Apparently about to do a song and dance for you?" Kurt looked at Knuckles and he said, "Hey, you didn't say it was classified." I stood up, shook his hand, and said, "Apparently this ceremony is so horrible you scared off the one guy who was supposed to get the award." Kurt's expression became grim. "Something else scared Guy off. I just hope he's taking the time to deal with it."
Chapter 15. Guy George laid out his new identity on the hotel bed, checking one more time to see if he could find anything indicating they were forged. Passport, credit cards, driver's license, and cellular phone. All in the name of Sean Parnell. And all looked perfect. It was decision time. Kill or not kill? It had been a week since he'd received the box with his brother's belongings, and he'd spent the days working in the task force headquarters, studying intelligence, and helping the analyst focus on various threats around the world. It was an easy, mindless task. No stress and no danger. In between, he focused on his target package, building linkages and fleshing out what he knew of the Qatari man Kurt had called Haider al-Attiyah, the man his brother knew as Abu Kamal. In the back of his mind, he'd toyed with the fantasy of hunting down the faces on the armband, a daydream that helped him to pass the time. Using his training and knowledge, he constructed exactly how he would do it. Cornering the man in one climactic fight, having him beg for his life, then taking it violently. Eventually, he began working the problem back from the actual confrontation. Back to the beginning, occupying his mind with a fantasy to alleviate the pain. How would he do it if he had no help from the task force? What assets would he need? How could he evade the very net he worked for? With an insider's perspective, he worried the problem like a piece of meat stuck in his teeth, day after day, over and over again. The first hurdle was finding an ambush location. Qatar was the obvious choice, since the target lived there, and more than likely the other faces on the armband did too. The Russians had killed some Chechens there a few years ago, and he knew Doha pretty well. The primary problem would be accessing the target. He would be on Haider's home turf, and getting in, killing him, and getting out would be difficult. Not to mention he'd need to interrogate the subject before termination. He would have to learn the real names and locations for the other pictures on the sleeve. He decided he needed a different location, someplace neutral, where the target would hold no advantage, which meant more research into the target's habits and movements. In his daydream, he set that aside for the moment. Mindlessly working with the analysts, answering their questions and helping them focus on real-world targets, his daydreams began moving further back upstream, focusing on the mechanics. What would he need for the mission, the actual nuts and bolts? He'd done enough clandestine kill-capture missions to understand exactly what was required. And for this fantasy mission, it was easier than a task force operation. He had no need to worry about exfiltrating with the target to some support facility for interrogation, or about infiltrating an entire team, or worst of all, waiting on the Oversight Council for permission.
The more he thought about it, the more he realized that the entire mission profile would be much less complicated. And the task force, the end state of an Omega operation, was no evidence. No trace that a mission had even occurred. In his daydream, that didn't matter. He would leave the body where it lay. But he still needed some items. Weapons he could get, even untraceable ones. It would require touching contacts he had made in the past, working for the task force. And maybe a healthy dose of cash, but he could do it. With his savings, he could buy cell phones, rent vehicles, and charge plane tickets. He could afford all of it, but ran afoul of what that would require. Each purchase would be tied to him, to his identity. This presented a significant problem. He had more than one target to kill, and if his name was attached to the first one, the task force would be hunting him, using everything they had. For all of the information and knowledge he had gained working there, they had also learned about him. They had every bit of data on the life of Guy George that could be obtained, to include biometrics. They'd stop his ability to operate within seconds, yanking his credit cards, revoking his passport, and putting him on a no-fly list. Greater than that, though, was the loyalty he owed to his country. He understood the implications of task force exposure, and any investigation of him by a foreign intelligence organization would lead to his military history, then possibly to the task force. He was aggravated at the cavalier attitude the Oversight Council and the task force had taken about his brother, but he still was faithful. Such an exposure would irreparably harm the defense of the nation he'd sworn to protect. And thus, his mission would have the added stricture of protecting his men, his friends. In his daydream, of course. After work, he'd taken to doing research on the internet, leading him to the stinking underbelly of the dark web. A place frequented by criminals and pedophiles. He'd learned that just about anything could be purchased if the price was right. For instance, he could have a fake passport overnight, but it would only fool a bouncer at a bar. Getting one that would fool a customs official, with holograms and an RFID chip that duplicated a real United States passport, required more time and more information. He needed a name and social security number that was valid, one that was already in the database of the giant behemoth of the United States government. And wasn't in use by someone else. He'd never considered the problem of traveling in alias before, with the myriad of databases that had to be cleared, simply because the documents he'd held had been provided by the U.S. government. He hadn't needed to worry about someone checking if they were real, because they were real. He toyed with the idea of stealing his task force alias documents for his fantasy mission. After all, he was working in the headquarters and could draw them without question. He'd already memorized the fake life they represented, and it would shield the task force from exposure, but wouldn't solve the original problem. The task force would recognize they'd been taken immediately, and then began cutting off the ties that allowed him to operate just as surely as if he were using his real identity. He was forced to build from scratch, which meant a name and social security number. A person who was real, but no longer using them. And he hit on a stroke of genius. Late one night, lying in bed and toying with his problem, he remembered a man he'd served with who'd been killed in Iraq. His name was Sean Parnell, and he had gone to Ranger School with Guy in 1998, before identity theft had become a problem. Back then, the military used soldiers' social security numbers for everything. It was stamped all over, willy-nilly, on flight manifests, duffel bags, and on official army orders. Guy had gone to his closet, digging through his personal files, looking for his orders, awarding him the coveted Ranger tab. He found it, holding it under the light of a bedside lamp, name after name listed, with the social security numbers beside them. He found Parnell's name, then jotted down the number. Just in case. The next day, after work, he had contacted a seller on the deep web, telling himself it was just for research. He wasn't really going to do anything with a passport. It was just an experiment to see how such things worked. The task force, chasing terrorists, might want to know how easy it was. 4 days later, using a post office box rented with yet another alias name, he had his passport. A day after that, he had a driver's license, a real one from Virginia, which allowed him to open a new bank account. 2 days after that, his alter identity complete, the data from Pike's mission in the Caymans had floated across his desk. Haider al-Attiyah was supposed to be the one at the party, but according to Pike's initial report, he hadn't shown, and Guy had lost interest. Eventually, the finalized roll-up of the mission had arrived, including a photo of the man who had attended. His name was Ahmed Mansour, and nobody in the task force had any data on him. He was a ghost. While the task force focused on Brazilian mines, yacht trips to Key West, and Cotter conspiracies involving rare earth metals, Guy focused on the photograph. It matched another face from the target package, one of the pictures without a name. And this man had gone to the Cayman Islands in lieu of Haider. It was proof positive that Haider was involved in his brother's death. The coincidence was too great to ignore. No way would both pictures be on his brother's arm in Afghanistan. And now both working with the same entity from Qatar. He'd taken the information to Kurt, and his commander had given him a look of sympathy. With the additional information, Kurt had promised to bring it to the Oversight Council. But Guy had seen the futility behind Kurt's eyes. That night, he'd lain in bed and made his decision, his first tentative step out of the daydream and into reality. The next day, he'd put in for leave, claiming he now wanted to go to Montana for his brother's memorial. He'd avoided Kurt Hale all day long and then had flown not to Montana, but to Key West, Florida, Ahmed Mansour's current location. This ends Disc 2.